Hey, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I'm just popping in to tell you that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Bob Kinzel. No one pretends that dairy farming has ever been an easy endeavor. It's painstaking physical work that demands daily pre-dawn wake-ups, constant maintenance of the land, the farm equipment, and the well-being of the cows that produce the milk. But it's even tougher these days. The State Agency of Agriculture estimates there are just under 700 dairy farms operating in Vermont, and that is down from around 1,100 just 10 years ago. That drop-off can be attributed to a number of factors, but one of them is the low price of milk, a trend that's been happening for several years in a row and is making it impossible for some farms, especially smaller ones, to survive. And while there are dairy farms operating, in some instances just a stone's throw from Vermont across the border in Quebec, they are not dealing with those same low milk price struggles. That's because in Canada, farmers have a degree of economic protection from Ottawa's supply management system. That's something we'll learn more about from one of our guests who is with us today. And his name is Gerard Vermeulen, a dairy farmer from Notre-Dame de Steinbridge, Quebec. And Gerard, I apologize for my inelegant reading of that lovely Quebecois name. But in any event, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Also joining me in our VPR studios in Colchester is Abby Corse, an organic farmer at the Corse Farm in Whitingham. Abby, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And with us from our studios in Norwich is conventional dairy farmer Paul Doten, a partner in the Doten Farm in Barnard, Vermont. Paul, so great to have you with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And we'll be hearing from our dairy farmers in just a moment. First, though, we're going to speak with Laura Ginsburg. Laura is the Agricultural Development Section Chief for Vermont's Agency of Agriculture, Food, and Markets, and is organizing the Northern Tier Dairy Summit. That's taking place April 1st and 2nd at Jay Peak Resort. Laura, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
What is the purpose of this summit at Jay Peak?
The Dairy Summit is really focusing on generating ideas that are actionable and timely and relevant in response to what's going on in the dairy industry. And we know that a lot of dairy farmers and folks in the industry say that something needs to change. Oftentimes that something is price or the amount of milk that's being produced. But that's not something that individual state like Vermont or a region or an individual farmer has any control over. And so this summit is really focused on those things that we can control so that we can start to turn the tide and have really generative conversations without waiting for the federal government to make a decision about price or supply.
Well, can you give me an example of something that you think you can control that isn't dependent on the federal government taking action?
Sure. So one of the sessions that we're having is about grazing. And grazing is a great production strategy that many farms already use. Some intensively graze their cows and rotate them frequently, and some graze a little bit more in a relaxed fashion. But grazing can be an opportunity where the cows are harvesting the feed themselves, and it doesn't require very much equipment at all to be productive and successful. And one of our keynote speakers is coming from New Zealand to talk about how grazing is one of their primary strategies and just what that means for them. And knowing that systems are different everywhere, maybe we can graze more productively and feed our cows more cheaply for 6 months out of the year. So just thinking about how we can be flexible in systems like that are the topics that we're trying to focus on.
And who's being asked to attend the summit? Is it just for dairy farmers, or do you want others to get involved?
We have about 250 attendees coming, wow. And right now about 125 of them are dairy farmers from across New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Connecticut. So we're really excited about the turnout with dairy farmers. And then the remaining folks in attendance run the gamut of feed dealers to technical assistance providers to lenders to people that are just genuinely interested in supporting dairy or figuring out what they can do to help move the industry in a positive direction.
And briefly, Laura, are you hopeful about the future of the dairy farming industry in Vermont?
I am. I'm very hopeful. Dairy farmers are innovative and committed and tenacious, and with some positive notes, you know, coming out of this dairy summit, I really think that we can make some changes in the right direction that'll be helpful to a lot of people.
Laura Ginsberg is the Agricultural Development Section Chief for Vermont's Agency of Agriculture, Food and Markets, organizing the Northern Tier Dairy Summit. That's taking place April 1st and 2nd at Jay Peak Resort. Laura, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right, let's get into our discussion now with our roundtable of dairy farmers here. And Paul Doten, I want to start with you, and I want to make sure that I'm not overstating the problem here. Is conventional dairy farming, as we know it, a kind of endangered species in the state of Vermont?
That's a difficult question to answer. There is a lot of positive things that are going on that make dairy possible in the state of Vermont. We also want to make sure it isn't just small conventional dairy farms that are having problems. It's all sizes and all styles of management.
What's the hardest part of the job? I mean, is it the day-to-day work itself on the farm or those things that are more beyond control, like the low price of milk?
That's the low price of milk, trying to figure out a way that, like Laura is talking about, to make the same amount of milk that we're making now at a less price, a less cost on the part of each individual dairy farm.
Abby Course, you're a farmer in Whitingham, Vermont, but unlike Paul, you focus on organic farming. And even though that's a term that's become more commonplace, let's say in the last 10 or 20 years, can you give us a brief primer on how organic farming differs from conventional dairy farming?
Oh, well, that would take more than the hour that we have potentially, but I'll do my best to
give us the Crib Notes
short
version if you could.
I mean, the main differences are that it costs double to produce organically than it does conventionally. The primary shifts that farms in Vermont, for example, have to go through to transition to organic requires paying for organic grain and organic fertilizer, both of which cost twice as much as conventional fertilizer and conventional grain. The most difficult part about transitioning to organic is that the last year when the animals transition, they have to be fed organic grain while you're still receiving the conventional price. And so what we're finding now is that there certainly are many conventional farms who are interested in making the transition to organic, but they're unable to fiscally make it through that last year of transition and therefore aren't able to do it. We can't use antibiotics. We can't use chemical fertilizers. We can't use insecticides, et cetera. So there's a lot of, it's tough for us. It was a lot of small adjustments that we need to make. You also have very strict pasture standards and requirements. And so your cows have to have a certain number of days on pasture in order to be at least through Organic Valley, certified organic.
That does sound like a real challenge. I wonder, though, if there is a slight advantage that you have on the other end of this in that you have kind of a niche market for people who may be willing to pay more for an organic milk product. Is that right?
Without a doubt. I feel I can confidently say that our farm, I don't think, would be in business if we hadn't made the transition to organic for a number of reasons, one of which would be that for me personally, it's how I believe in farming philosophically. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't interested in farming conventionally. So I sort of pushed my father along that path.
When did you make that transition? I find that really interesting.
We transitioned officially. Our certification was official in May of 2008. And we've been shipping to Organic Valley ever since.
You're glad you made that decision.
Oh, so glad.
Gerard Vermeulen, let's help us understand for our listeners here in Vermont and perhaps beyond these protections that you have in place from the Canadian government when it comes to the price of milk. Do you have to worry as much about low milk prices as your friends who farm in Vermont do?
No, we know from pretty well from month to month what we're going to get for a paycheck.
And why is that? What's keeping that so stable?
Well, we have a system, a quota system. So we know that we have a certain supply of milk we have to furnish to the processor at a certain price.
Mm-hmm.
The price will vary a little bit depending on, we have different classes of milk. If there is more milk that goes to fluid, well, our price will go up. If more milk goes to cheeses, well, it will go a little bit down to butter is less. We have so that's how our prices change. But basically, it doesn't vary that much.
And if the price of milk gets too low, the Canadian government steps in and offers you a subsidy. Is that how it works?
No. All our price comes from the market, from the consumer.
So
we get no subsidies.
What happens then if the price is too low? You know, based on what you're trying to do, what your production costs are.
But our price is based on cost of production. They check it out. They have certain. It's looked at. They make a survey.
It's the price that's dictated.
Yes.
I see. Okay, yes. And that's worked out well for you for how many years? How long has your farm been in operation?
Well, I've started in 2004, but the quota system has been in place since, I believe, 68 or 70, 1968 or 1970.
I'm going to ask you guys to get into something here that might be a little bit difficult to explain, but let's get a sense of what the prices that you're paid for the milk you produce. And Paul, let's start with you. What kind of prices are you paid for milk these days? And if you can try to put it in terms that a non-farmer like me would understand, so much the better.
Might I make a comment?
Sure, absolutely.
Abby's? I didn't want to interrupt Abby, but make sure we all understand there's a surplus of milk in the United States for all, including organic.
Including
yes.
organic.
Thank you.
There are
that
some
is
people
true.
Who are trying to transition to organic now, and there's not a market for them.
Right.
I'm not saying that negatively. I'm just saying what the facts are.
Yeah, and we do want to get the facts straight.
Yes. I'm not contradicting
you,
Abby,
no.
But I just want
it's good.
Abby, but I just wanted to make sure. She and I were on a panel about a month and a half ago, so
we're
we
buds.
Know how we can
that's
talk.
Good. Yeah, there's no animosity here.
back to the price of milk.
Yeah.
We do it in dollars per hundredweight.
Mm-hmm.
In the month of March, the check we just got, second check, for the February milk, we get paid the following month after we produce the milk. And depending on the components and the distance from market and a lot of other factors is what we get. We got $17.28 for our milk for February.
Now, I'm guessing that sounds like a pretty low price.
Yes. 5 years ago, conventional milk was bringing $25 to $26 a hundred. It wasn't difficult to budget for $26, $27 a hundred. It is a little more difficult to budget for $17 milk.
Paul, do you mind me asking, does that cover your cost of production?
At the present time, it does because we are diversified.
Ah.
What else do you do?
We make maple syrup. Well, uh-huh. we intend to this year. We haven't boiled yet, but we still got snow up to our waist in the woods, so there's still hope. We also, my son plows snow, 25 driveways within 2 miles of the farm. We also grow sweet corn in the summer. We do not have any outside labor, and our debt level is not high. So I've been on a farm since I was born there, 1950. My parents moved there in 1949. Our son came on board in 2005, the year after he graduated from high school. So we have kept the cost down. We do try to keep things neat and clean around the farm, and we also try to include the community in our farm.
And Paul, does your son intend to stick with this? Do you think that he'll follow you in your footsteps?
We formed an LLC the January after he graduated from high school. At the present time, he owns more of the LLC than my wife and I do, but we still own the buildings and the land. We also, I'll just add, we have a grandson who was born 10 months ago, and he likes to look out the window at tractors, so there is hope.
Congratulations. Abby, same question to you as I asked Paul. What are you getting paid for milk these days?
We are currently getting paid $36 a hundredweight. We do – Organic Valley actually does function somewhat similarly to the Canadian system in that we have a quota in place right now. We have to actively manage the milk supply. As Paul said, we have more milk than we can sell. Mm-hmm. Even in the organic market, it is saturated. So and there are all sorts of things that go into that pay price. So, for example, the baseline – 100 weight pay price right now, my dad just figured it for me, is around $31 a 100 weight in the Northeast. It does vary somewhat regionally within Organic Valley. And there are different things in place to try to offset the seasonal flushes of milk. So there's an incentive in the winter for milk production because it tends to be down. So you get $3 more a hundredweight in the winter for what they call winter incentive. And then in spring flush for May, June, and July, it's $2 down. And then in addition, we're compensated for quality premiums. So if you have a somatic cell count per a certain level, you receive more money. So the higher quality milk you're putting into the tank, the higher your pay price.
And are you getting enough to cover your cost of production?
At the moment, ish.
Ish. Ish. Okay.
We benefit from having been in business for 150 years.
Wow.
I'm the sixth generation to be farming on our land. And all the generations, may I keep this up, are incredible financial managers. Our debt is very low. The only debt we currently have was for our solar panels, which, you know, eventually will pay themselves off.
Right.
And so it takes close to the vest financial management to make it through on that. But yes, at the moment, we are covering our costs.
Before we get to a break, I'm going to ask Gerard the same question, but it's going to be more difficult because we're talking Canadian dollars versus American dollars. How can you explain this to us in a pretty easy way here?
Okay. What do we call a standard hectoliter?
Okay.
100 liters of milk, which is roughly 220 pounds.
Thank you.
Standard hectoliter is 3.6 fat butterfat, 3.2 protein. I believe it's 5.6 lactose. And I
trust you to believe that. Yeah, you could tell me, quite frankly, anything that I would have
to
believe.
Well, anyways, it's about $70 for 220 pounds. I made some rough calculations, which is about $31 a 100 pounds Canadian,
okay,
minus 30% exchange, which is about $22 U.S. for 100 pounds at 3.6 fat, 3.2 protein. That's what I'm getting.
That's a little bit better than what Paul is doing, not quite as much as what Abby is getting in those translated dollars. But again, you're not really sweating this too much, I would imagine. Is that a good price for you?
It was better in the past years.
Okay.
But I believe it's a decent price.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Bob Kinzel. We have three dairy farmers with us today for the entire program, sharing their experiences and offering insight into what changes they would like to see in their industry. You can join this conversation by calling 800-639-2211. Are you concerned by the shrinking number of dairy farms in Vermont? What concerns you about the dairy industry? You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.org. We have a caller on the line from Canterbury, New Hampshire. David is with us. Hi, David.
Hey, good to hear you in there. I really enjoy these kind of discussions. I'm going to be 79 tomorrow.
Hey, congratulations. Happy birthday.
I can remember my father and grandfather peddling milk with a buckboard wagon before they even were doing it with a panel truck.
Wow.
So I've been around farming some, and I'm kind of semi-retired now, and I look on a big dairy farm of which has been spreading human sludge, excrement from these sewage treatment plants, on these corn pieces for over 20 years.
Hmm.
When is organic going to come out and say, hey, we don't use human excrement on our corn pieces anymore, and make a distinction in the market so people know, hey, I'm getting milk that is made clean and pure and not from all the pharmaceuticals that people are peeing and putting down the flush and going on the corn pieces. It makes no sense to go on farming like people are doing it.
Well, David, thank you very much for that call. Abby, would you like to address that question?
I would like to put forward the thought that I don't know of any. This is news to me, but yes, organic, we do not use human waste to fertilize our fields, for sure.
Paul Doten, is that something that you've heard about?
Well, I've heard about it, but I don't do it.
So this is not an issue, Gerard?
I know in Canada, they also spread a human sludge, but you cannot use it for vegetables that go to a cannery. And I guess they don't use it in the organic either. But I don't know about the organic part for the dairy. I'm not aware.
I do.
Oh, go ahead, Abby. Yeah.
I think that this brings up something that I think about a lot, which is that So much of what I think we're experiencing in our food system today is a lack of active consumer education, whether on the part of the consumer or on the part of the infrastructure, to help people understand what is happening within food production and how food production works. I think that we've become removed from nature, and our expectations of food production have become unrealistic. I've been told in posting photos and things like that, for example, that I shouldn't be posting things that are dirty or show, you know, a dirty animal or an animal behind a fence or things like that. And
but this is farming.
Well, that's my thought on it. But unfortunately, in general, the general consumer is so busy with their day-to-day life. You know, people are struggling in general. So they're so busy that they don't have the time to stop and understand how food is produced and the differences that happen in how food production occurs.
I'd like to add on that. I believe now there are so little people that understand farming. There's less farmers. Back in the day, you had people in the towns, but you always had a cousin or somebody that, and in the summer, well, you'd go see those, right, the farmer cousin in the country, and he understood how food was being made.
Mm-hmm.
He understood that, well, you have to kill cattle to have beef, and they understand all these things. But now the people that live away from the farms, they don't understand the way farming works and the way nature works. And that's the big problem.
Well, let me bring up this point then, because this is going to be a difficult one, and I'm going to ask you all to answer this. We got this comment from someone calling themselves House Crow, who posted this on our Facebook page. Why should we pay more, one way or another, for dairy products to support an industry that is polluting our waterways? What other industry is so sacred that we are supposed to accept both pollution and higher prices? Not sure about those higher prices, but anyway, my children swim in Lake Champlain. I can see with my own eyes brown manure-laden water coming into the lake from Dead Creek, the Missisquoi River, Little Otter Creek, etc. It's disgusting. The argument is, well, if we didn't have farms, we'd have more housing developments. How so, says House Crow, when we have a shrinking population in Vermont? I make every effort to buy dairy products from other states because my children swim in Lake Champlain. That sounds pretty harsh. Paul, let's start with you. You can't deny lake pollution is a big concern in Vermont. How would you address these concerns?
I am addressing it from the Connecticut Riverside. There is a river there, obviously, that is cleaner than Lake Champlain, but we are not pointing fingers at anybody. We are working. I am chairman of a group called Connecticut River Watershed Farmers Alliance to be proactive, to make sure we have people working to keep the water clean, as are a majority of the farms on the Lake Champlain side of the state. And remember, it isn't just farms that are contributing to the problem at Lake Champlain. The fingers are being pointed at something like 40% of the problem comes from farms. It is a group effort. We have to work together and not point fingers at one another.
Abby?
Yeah, I would agree with that wholeheartedly. There was an issue, I believe it was last year, with Lake Carmi, and Heather Darby, who works at UVM and does a ton of amazing research, actually was able to go and show that the farmers were not responsible for the pollution that had been caused and were, in fact, the people who were working hardest to mitigate it. I don't think that the average person realizes the regulations that are in place for farmers. A few years ago, water quality regulations were put in place. They're called required agricultural practices. All farms have to become certified and have to follow these practices, or they're out of compliance with the agency of ag and therefore face repercussions for that. I don't think enough can be said about the expectations that are put on farmers. We don't make enough money, and and yet are held to standards that the average person, if they had any concept of, would be bowled over by. The other thing that I wish that we could consider more broadly is that the nuance has been completely lost in the conversation about farming practices. There's a big difference in farming management styles, even within the state of Vermont. Factory farming causes a lot of problems. We don't have, I would say, we don't have many.
You're talking about larger farms when you say
right.
factory farms.
We don't have many CAFOs in Vermont.
And, I'm sorry, CAFOs?
Confinement, I can't, Paul?
It's a large farm operation state of Vermont.
Basically. It's a large farm operation. Okay. The point I'm trying to make is that the average farmer, because of these required agricultural practices, is having to put into place systems that address climate issues. So you're having to think about cover cropping. You're having to more farmers are thinking about no-till methods for carbon sequestration. So there's a lot of things that are going on farms, even conventional farms, that are helping with serious environmental degradation. You know, we survive because of 9 inches of topsoil, and farmers that are putting into place these water quality practices and management styles are actually actively working to build topsoil and sequester carbon.
Gerard,
it also needs to be mentioned
yes.
that these farmers have been putting millions of their own dollars into these projects,
yes.
practices, and there isn't a way to measure the success of these projects. That's something we're working on now, ecosystem services payments, to get farmers to find out what practice works on each individual field almost, and then implement those practices and be able to prove that that practice has enhanced the quality of the water moving through their farm.
I want to get this perspective as well from Gerard briefly, because I wonder if you're hearing any similar criticism of dairy farming pollution and its effects in Quebec, let's say waterways like Lake Memphremagog.
We have many rules, environmental laws in Quebec that we have to follow. We have nutrient management plans we have to produce every year. Our phosphorus has to be balanced. If we produce more phosphorus on our farm and we don't have enough land, we have to export that phosphorus, the manure. That's all figured out every year. That has to be in check. And this goes to the government. They know about all this. But also in Quebec, our farms are much smaller. And I think the bigger the farm, there's more pressure on the environment. And there's also another thing I'd like to bring up. If you're producing, I don't know, 5 or 10% more product than you really need,
mm-hmm.
you're not just wasting the product. You're consuming all kinds of energy for a product you're not using. Just getting rid of that excess is already going to help you on both ends.
We're going to go back to you for a question we just got from John in South Stratford, who wants to know, many of Vermont dairy farms are dependent on undocumented migrant farm workers from Mexico, and they would like to know from you, Gerard, if Canadian dairy farmers have that same issue in Quebec.
We're getting also bigger farms in Quebec. We have migrant workers, mostly Guatemalans. But it's very, very regulated.
Not so much undocumented, you're saying.
No. It all goes through the government. They come and see how the workers are housed. It's very, very strict.
Abby and Paul. Abby, let's start with you. Kevin and Shelburne would like to know, please address the percentage of migrant farm workers that allow the dairy farms to function. Do you have migrant farm workers working for you?
No. And never have. Actually, currently, we have a really exciting, we just started with the Dairy Grazing Apprenticeship Program, which is a new program that's come is trying to work its way into the Northeast. My dad was the first master grazer in Vermont. We were the first farm to have an apprentice. He actually could graduate within the next few weeks. It's a program that's recognized by the Department of Labor. So he leaves basically having had a technical training. He's here for 2 years and leaves with a certificate that says he can move forth as a grass-based farmer. So he's our labor, our external labor force right now.
Well, Paul Dalton, I think you had mentioned before, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that you do not have a migrant farmers working for you on your farm. Is that right?
That is correct.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you then, how do you feel about when you hear about other farms in Vermont that do depend on these workers? Because many of them do.
Well, they can't find the local labor force that will show up at 2 o'clock in the morning to start work or to work until midnight to finish milking the cows. The comment that's been made by the ones that I have come across, other dairy farmers, there are documents that are produced by this workforce, and who are the farmers to know whether the document is correct or not?
Yeah. And they need the help. They absolutely need the help.
Yes, many of them could not farm without this help.
We got this comment from Christina on Facebook who said, my family had a dairy farm in Connecticut that went out of business during the farm crisis of the 80s. I went to school for agriculture, and I have worked on dairy farms in Vermont and Canada. But as my grandfather used to say, the difference between being in jail and milking cows is that when you're in jail, you don't have to milk cows. As much as I love farm work, cows, and local food, I work as a teacher because I have things like health insurance and time off. And I think what Christina's point is here is that farm work is really, really hard. Abby, would you agree with that?
Oh, my friend, we could talk for days. I was never going to be a farmer. It is shocking to anybody that knew me growing up that I have returned to the farm. It's a long story, but I'm there because I love to be outside, and because I don't think you realize when you've grown up on a farm how deeply ingrained the cycles and the rhythms and the seasons become tied into how you function as a being. And so it almost was, you know, when I was working off the farm, I worked at the Flynn Center, I worked at the Telluride. I had these great jobs and these great places, and I just May would come and I was like, get me out. You know, it was time to go out in the hayfield. And so that inevitably pulled me back. I also was thinking about, you know, the way in which I wanted to raise my kids. But there's no question, I make it my personal goal to milk cows as infrequently as possible.
Not your favorite part of the
job. Oh, my God, I hate it. It's a running joke. My theory is that I'm only one person trying to take over from two, and so I can't be expected to do everything. So if I do everything else, I should, within reason, be able to make somebody else milk cows.
We have to head to another break in just a moment, but very quickly, I want to get this idea from you, Gerard. Is this something that you fell into? Has this been in your family for years? Were you always meant to be a farmer? And then, Paul, I'm going to ask you the same question.
My father comes from Europe, from Belgium. He immigrated here in 1951, and we were farmers. Our family was farmers in Belgium, but I was born on the farm, and it's a way of life, and I think it's the best place to raise a family.
Mm.
And
Paul, way of life for you too?
Yes, but it has to be a business, and it has to be profitable to pass it on to the next generation.
That's something I'd like to – you have – you can love your work as much as you want, but if you're not making a little bit of money, you have to make some money. After a while, you're going to hate it.
I'm at the opposite end of the scale from Abby. I wanted to be a farmer from the day I was born.
I think we can certainly tell that from your enthusiasm.
Four younger siblings, and they had to matriculate through the farm before I could come back. And when I came back in 1978 after graduating from University of Massachusetts in Amherst and working for a grain company and a dairy farm off the farm, that was what I really wanted to do.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertleben for Bob Kinzel. As we heard earlier, the Northern Tier Dairy Summit is taking place next week in Jay, April 1st and 2nd, so we thought this was a perfect opportunity to hear directly from area farmers on the state of the dairy industry. And joining me today in our VPR studios in Colchester, Abby Course of the Course Farm Dairy in Whitingham, and we have Gerard Vermelin, a dairy farmer in Notre-Dame de Stembridge, Quebec, and on the phone with us from Norwich is Paul Doten of the Doten Farm in Barnard. They are sharing the challenges, the joys of dairy farming, their thoughts on the future of dairy farming. This might be a good time to go to the phones. We have Tyler on the line from St. Johnsbury. Hi, Tyler.
Hi.
Go ahead. You have a question for our panel today?
I do. I guess I have a comment and then a question. So one of your guests mentioned changing kind of the way the public is educated about milk quality and shifting the way in which quality is assessed, really. There's a program called the Farm Program, F-A-R-M, and listeners can learn more at nationaldairyfarm.com. Mm-hmm. It's a voluntary program that any dairy farmer can participate in, and it holds producers to really rigorous standards in four categories: animal care, the environment, antibiotics, and workforce development. So making sure there's safe environment for the workers, good environmental stewardship, appropriate antibiotic use, and as well as high standards of animal health and happiness, really. And so I'm curious if any of your so I think that's a step in the right direction, although there's not necessarily economic incentives to participate in it directly. Mm-hmm. But I was wondering if any of your guests have participated or are familiar with this program.
Thank you, Tyler.
Can I answer that, please?
Go right ahead, Paul.
Yeah. It isn't a voluntary program. In January 1st, 2020, everybody who wants to ship milk will be required to be part of that program. It is a program that covers all the people who buy milk nationwide and even worldwide. So we don't have somebody coming from each of the buyers to inspect our farms. So it is not a voluntary program. It is a nationwide third-party checked mandatory program.
You think that's a good thing, Paul?
Yes, it is a very good thing.
Okay. Let's go to Keith, who's in Moortown. Keith, you're on Vermont Edition.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I moved here in 87 and became friends with the Von Trapps here in Waitsfield, and they were excited because the price of milk per 100 pound was going up to $12. And if I'm not mistaken, it's right around that still today, between $12 and $14 for that 100 pounds of raw milk, which, you know, the big milk truck would come up the muddy road and pick up. And now there's a glut of milk, and everybody is jumping to do value-added artisanal products like cheese and selling the whey and all that kind of stuff to make ends meet. Or even the Neal farm in town went to selling beef instead of milking cows. So is the recumbent bovine growth hormone glut just affecting, stagnating the whole entire market? And my final thing is I think there should be more squeaky cheese curds here in Vermont. And
that sounds delicious. Thank you very much, Keith. I appreciate that. Abby, any thoughts on that? On what's the causing this glut of milk, if you will?
Well, in the organic market is really all I can speak to intelligently. And that was caused by the rate of growth was so quick, and we took on, you know, we were behind and took on as many farms as possible. Mm-hmm. And then demand slowed in large part, per my understanding, with market trends. And that can be pretty directly attributed to plant-based, quote unquote, milks. Lewis Black does a very funny segment on nut milks.
I'm going to look that up.
You should Google it for sure.
I think I will. Not suitable for today's program.
We don't put the two together.
Juice, right. Right. We don't put the two. If it doesn't come from a teat, I believe is something to do. And so it dropped off has started to drop off quite suddenly, but we had taken on so many farmers that the production went over before we could, you know, before we could manage the supply. And I think that we need to rebrand milk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these plant-based alternatives don't offer the same nutritional value yeah. as milk does. They don't have the same protein. They don't have the same trace minerals. In organic, there's proven higher omega-3s and linoleic acid content. And so I don't know how we do it, but certainly that's contributed.
We're running a little short on time. And one thing I really want to get to before we do run out of time is this question about what Gerard was talking about before with the supply management system in Canada. Paul Doten, is that something that you think could happen in the U.S.? Do you think it should happen in the U.S.? Have there been efforts before to stabilize this market for, you know, U.S. farmers, dairy farmers?
The background of that is that there have been many attempts to do that in the Farm Bill. The only way it can be enacted is at the national level. Congress has not seen fit to do that. We had the Northeast Dairy Compact that was done away with by Texas and the Speaker of the House back several years ago. I'm a member of the Vermont Milk Commission. We were tasked by the legislature to design a program to be presented to our congressional delegation. We have termed it the Growth Management Program, not a Supply Management Program, because under that, people would be able to produce as much milk as they wanted, but any that was beyond what was needed would bring a very low price. If these farms wanted to continue to produce that milk way over what their base was, they could do that, but it would be done at a very low price.
And again, this is
– That's the quick overview of what that is. There will be more discussion at that at the Dairy Summit.
And it would have to happen, as you said, at the federal level. It would have to get through Congress. We have Gerard here who has been smiling and nodding his head at your comments there, Paul. Gerard, the other advantage I think that Canadian farmers would have is the national health system in Canada, right? I mean, they help out in the area of medical expenses. There are accidents that happen on the farm. People get sick.
The only way you're going to have a good system, everybody has to be on board.
Yes.
There's no other way. That's why it works in Canada. Everybody's on board. Each province works a little bit differently, but everybody's on board. No one dumps milk into somebody else's province unless they need to. If a province is not producing enough and one is producing a little bit too much, well, they can help out. But everybody has to be on board at the same time.
I want to take one more call very quickly. Ryan is in Stowe. Ryan, you've got some brief moments here with our panel. Go ahead.
Hi. I just have a comment and maybe a quick question. A person called in not long ago saying that she buys her milk from out-of-state farmers and because her kids swim in Lake Champlain, and she's blaming the farmers for the pollution of Lake Champlain. My question and comment would be, what about the millions of gallons of raw sewage from all the communities around the lake and on the streams that feed the lake that constantly have overflows into the lake whenever there's a storm? Those antiquated sewage systems have been around forever, and we don't seem to be doing a thing about it. Hmm. And I'd be interested if she'd be willing to raise her taxes to pay to clean up the lake. I think the farmers are getting a bad rap.
Ryan, thank you very much for that comment. We'll wrap it up here with some final thoughts from you folks. And I wanted to ask about basically whether you're a half glass of milk empty or a half glass of milk full here on the future of dairy farming. So briefly to each of you, let's start with you, Abby Course.
I think Vermont is at an inflection point. Our farmers are aging. We have to somehow incentivize young farmers to come in. I think that there are ways that we can do that, whether it's by providing health insurance to farmers or compensating for ecosystem services. But I was raised by a perpetual optimist, so I'll remain half full.
Paul Doten, optimist?
Yes, very much so. There's a great market on the East Coast for our product. The rural economy would be greatly affected by any further slippage of the number of farms. I just want to get back. Our BST is not being used at this point. One of the callers said it was.
That's the growth hormone.
Milk is more than $12 to $15, $14.
Okay.
And modern technology is what is bringing increased milk production.
Thank you, Paul. And Gerard, your feelings on dairy farming in Quebec? Optimistic about the future?
Yes, we have in Quebec. We have we're going to have a new plant coming on in Sorel this fall. Three new plants in Ontario. So I think production is going to go back up. Last year, we had a 5% quota cut. In March, they gave us 1% back. So I think the future is optimistic.
Thank you so much to our panel of dairy farmers today. Paul Doten of the Dorton Farm in Barnard. Paul, thank you so much.
Certainly. You're welcome.
Gerard Vermeulen, a dairy farmer in Notre Dame de Stanbridge, Quebec. Thank you for your time today.
Nice being here.
And Abby Corse of the Corse Farm Dairy in Whitingham. Such a pleasure to speak with you.
Honored to have been here.